Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Saints go marching in. The Saints win convincingly in the Super Bowl, and New Orleans takes a big step toward convincing the rest of the world that Katrina is off the field. The party is just beginning in the French Quarter. New Orleans spreads some well-earned bliss.
Oh, yes, I want to be in that number, yes.
On The Takeaway.
When the Saints go marching in.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, February 8th, and The Takeaway really, quite literally, is the party is just beginning in the city of the Big Easy.
And will continue probably all week long. We're joined now by Lola's Eric Eli. He joins us from New Orleans, where the Saints, of course, just won the Super Bowl. Lolas, that probably sounds relatively familiar to you. What does your city look like today?
Well, I tell you, I have barely gotten out of bed so far, but it was like that all night long last night.
And continuing this morning? People have not gone to bed, I assume.
Well, I tell you, we believe in party until there's no more party and that can be done.
And do you imagine? I don't know if when there is no more partying that can be done, Lolas.
Well, this has been such an incredible victory for us. The team didn't leave anything on the field, and we're not going to leave anything in the French Quarter.
Lola's Eric Eli is a former reporter for the Times-Picayune, joined us from New Orleans. We're going to talk more with him in just a moment.
We're going to explore some of the deeper themes of that Super Bowl victory by the New Orleans Saints overnight. In other news, Space Shuttle Endeavour blasted off this morning for the International Space Station.
Five, we have both ready to start. Two, one. Booster ignition and liftoff of Shuttle Endeavour.
The shuttle, with six on board, is carrying a dome-shaped observation deck that will, for the first time, give astronauts a panoramic view of space. Only four more shuttle flights are planned in the entire program after this one.
And in Middletown, Connecticut, the cleanup continues after a major blast at a power station yesterday. The plant was under construction. Investigators say five people died. It's still unclear if anyone else is buried under the rubble. The cause of the blast is being checked out, but terrorism has been ruled out. And despite the lowest unemployment figures in the nation, North Dakota has a growing homeless problem. Latest research shows desperate job seekers have flowed into the state looking for work. Some have found it. Many have not. In politics, Senator Charles Schumer says the message voters sent with Republican Scott Brown's upset victory in Massachusetts is clear. The focus should be on jobs. Senate Democrats are looking to push through a jobs bill this week. The Dow is going to start out this morning at 10,012. The S&P will open at 1,066, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,141. So we're going to be talking more about the Super Bowl in just a moment, but we're wondering, what's your takeaway from last night's Super Bowl?
My takeaway for the Super Bowl was the E-Trade commercials. That baby finally has new friends. He's traveling. He's even involved in a love triangle. He just gets more interesting every year.
As a friend of the show, Delana Dixon, what other takes do you have?
This is Patrick Henry Bass, and my takeaway from the Super Bowl was a great game, lame commercials with the exception of Hockenberry's very favorite comedian, Jay Leno, with Oprah and David Letterman.
I actually heard, that's Patrick Henry Bass, our friend of the show and contributor from Essence Magazine, but, you know, I actually heard that it was so hush-hush, the filming of that commercial with David Letterman and Oprah, and that Jay Leno showed up in a trench coat with a fake mustache in order to film it.
Well, indeed. If you have a takeaway from the game last night, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org, we're going to be looking at the longer arcs of history, really, in that victory. Sure, it was just a football game, but it was a lot of sort of vindication and redemption for the people of New Orleans who've struggled so mightily since Hurricane Katrina. We're going to talk about that in just a moment.
Good morning. It's party time in New Orleans.
Of the goal line,
Last night's Super Bowl victory, 31-17 of the Saints over the Indianapolis Colts. It was a victory for the football team, but it was also a victory for the city of New Orleans 4 years after Hurricane Katrina. As the sun was rising there this morning, we spoke with Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Bar, and he drew a direct line between last night's Super Bowl victory and Katrina.
Katrina could have been the greatest catastrophe to ever happen. This is probably the greatest uncatastrophe.
Jim Spalding clearly suffering after a long night of uncatastrophe-ing. This uncatastrophe comes 2 days after New Orleans elected a new mayor, Mitch Landrieu. He's the first white mayor of the city in 32 years.
We decided that we were going to stick the pole in the ground and strike a blow for unity. Strike a blow for a city that decided to be unified rather than divided.
So lots of things going on in New Orleans. Could this be a turning point for the city? We are joined now again by Lola's Eric Eli. He's the former reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, now a writer for the upcoming show Tremé, scheduled to premiere on HBO in April. And Kenneth Purcell joins us again, an entrepreneur and CEO of iSeats, a travel and technology company in New Orleans. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Have you both been to bed?
I have, but it was a great night, even though I did get to sleep around 2.
2 in the morning, that's still a short period of sleep. So let me start with you, Lolas. We're not too far away from Mardi Gras. I would imagine that this is expected to be a big week for New Orleans. People might be taking the entire week off.
Well, I tell you, Carnival season goes for a couple of weeks, so we're already in carnival season, though it's not Mardi Gras Day. And everywhere you go, all people have been talking about for the past 2 weeks of the Super Bowl. So work may be getting done, but it's certainly a bit distracted.
Well, I got to ask you, is this the first time, somebody said this morning that I saw in an interview, that this is the first time New Orleans has kind of recaptured that true celebratory mood that the city is famous for. Do you feel kind of a refreshed sense of victory and celebration there?
I can't say it's the first time, because the truth is, even in the 6 to 12 months after the storm, people were having parades as a means of reaffirming our culture and our celebration of being alive and seeing old friends. But the kind of unity behind this celebration is unprecedented in my lifetime.
Kenneth, let's talk to you real quickly. You're a CEO of iSeats, a company there in New Orleans. What kind of development might New Orleans see based on the Super Bowl victory, or maybe none at all?
Well, I walked down the street last night from my house at about, I guess, 9 o'clock, as soon as the game was over, as soon as they were handing the trophy over, and we're about 8 blocks from the foot of Bourbon Street. And so we walked down to Bourbon Street last night, and the positive energy in the air was electric. People were, you know, it was thousands and thousands of cars and just the 8 blocks walking to Bourbon Street and tens of thousands of people. It was a celebratory mood, but it was unlike anything that I've ever seen, and I'm born and raised here. So it was a happy gras as opposed to a Mardi Gras.
You know, there certainly is a lot.
It was unbelievable.
There's certainly a lot going on in your city right now. You know, Sean Payton last night, Lolas, and I wonder if you heard this, suggested that the trophy actually be broken up into a million little pieces to give to all the people in New Orleans and all the people scattered by Katrina who are New Orleans expat residents all over the country and the world. I thought that was a very profound point. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought as you did about it, that both Sean Payton and Drew Brees were very clear about the significance of what they did for the entire city. And I thought they showed a great deal of class and compassion in doing that.
Well, Kenneth...
Yeah, absolutely.
Kenneth, let me ask you about, you know, some of the other news coming out of New Orleans, and that's the election of Mitch Landrieu, the first white mayor in more than 3 decades. Is that also a sign of a turning tide in New Orleans?
Well, I think that regardless of the mayor's the color, which, you know, obviously there's some historical significance to Mitch being Caucasian, but the fact that we have a new mayor after Katrina, I think, is reason enough to celebrate. Mitch just happened to be, from my perspective, certainly well head and shoulders above, and I think the city of New Orleans voted resoundingly yes, we're ready to change. And you know, it was just it was that alone was so positive, and is going to, you know, potentially change the face for the city for the next 4 years. And the Super Bowl is a great celebration, and it's unbelievable, and we feel like, you know, this has never happened before. But I think that alone, the new mayor is ultimately is more significant than what we feel right now about the Saints and the Super Bowl. So I think the real change is going to come from the mayor's office. But the real emotion right now is, you know, things are going well for the city of New Orleans.
Lolas, in most cities, I guess statistically, they show that a Super Bowl win is relatively short-lived. But in cities that have been devastated, and, you know, I was recently just came to New York from Detroit, anything that's a morale booster for a city can actually have a huge change in terms of what happens in the months ahead. And I'm wondering how you feel about that. Do you think that this kind of boost for the city's attitude and morale could actually change people's working attitudes?
Well, I have never lived in another city when it won a Super Bowl. So I keep trying to compare what's happened here with what happens in other cities. My impression, though, and from talking to friends, is that the way in which we've celebrated this and the way in which it's been taken to heart throughout the city is different from everywhere else. And let me give an example that will resonate with you from being from Detroit. The Times-Picayune reprinted the Monday paper after the Saints won the national championship. We're headed to the Super Bowl, the national NFC championship. And they reprinted it again and reprinted it again. And in an era when newspapers are dying, you get that kind of enthusiasm, that kind of just wanting to be a part of it and wanting to have that as a keepsake.
Let's Lolas, Eric Eli, former reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, now a writer for the upcoming show Tremé, which is scheduled to premiere on HBO in April. Kenneth Purcell is an entrepreneur. He's CEO of iSeats, a travel and technology company in New Orleans. Congratulations to both of you. You can now say they are the national champs, Lolas. The Saints beat the Indianapolis Colts 31-17 in the Super Bowl last night.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines. This morning saw the pre-dawn launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. It's now rocketing towards the International Space Station, carrying a brand new observation deck that will allow astronauts a panoramic view of space. If you wondered what the link is between this story and another big story this morning, the Super Bowl, listen to members of the International Space Station were remarking on some of the gear that's being taken up to the International Space Station was actually built in New Orleans. In other news, most trains, planes, and buses in Washington, D.C. are still frozen in place as the cleanup continues after the Mid-Atlantic blizzard. The nation's capital is pretty well shut down again today, with schools and even parts of the government closed for the day.
President Obama said Sunday he'll convene a half-day bipartisan health care session at the White House to be televised live this month to try and break the political impasse over health care. And staying with politics, Senate Democrats are looking to push through a jobs bill this week. The final measure will likely include some tax cuts to win GOP support. And abroad, unmanned surveillance planes may soon be flying under Iran's insignia. Iran State TV says the country has launched two production lines of unmanned aircraft or drones. Iran said a year ago it's built an unmanned surveillance aircraft with a range of more than 600 miles. That's long enough to reach Israel. And that's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. More about the Super Bowl win last night for the Saints in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And our first news takeout takes you directly to last night's Super Bowl. It was supposed to be a high-scoring aerial contest. It wasn't, but it was a great game of pitting two fantastic offenses. And as our sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen predicted last week, it was all about the turnovers. That may have just locked it up. That Tracy Porter interception, one interception of the game, paid Peyton Manning through it, and in the end, it was all New Orleans Saints. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, you kind of called this one.
Yeah.
Recap the game for us.
It was a tough one.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Indianapolis got off to a 10-point lead. Yeah. And at that point, I would say it felt as though Indianapolis was charging ahead for their second Super Bowl. There was a fourth down stand that they had again when they stopped the Saints, and it was 10-3 at the time. Indiana held them, and at that point, the Colts had all the momentum in the game. Then we get into the second quarter, and it started to shift a little bit. New Orleans started to gain a little ground. They started to get a little momentum. They scored. They built some confidence, and then the Colts punted twice. They barely got on the field, and that's when I think Peyton Manning, the quarterback for the Colts, got a little iced. He got a little cold. He got a little stiff, and there was a little worry on the Colts side because the momentum was building. Come into the second half, and that's when things really started to change because Sean Payton, the coach for the New Orleans Saints, made a daring call the first time that an onside kick was done in the fourth quarter.
Well, nobody was expecting this.
Onside kick to start the second half, and the ball bounces off the hands of a Colt, and it looks like the Saints had it for a second, and it's Saints football. They recover the onside kick.
Hugely risky move, and it pays off, and it really put the Colts off guard, it seemed like.
It put them off guard, and then the Saints took advantage of it. I think it would have been one thing if they had done that and then the Colts had stopped them. If the Colts had stopped them, it would have changed the character of the game. But the Saints took that opportunity and drove quickly and scored a touchdown, and that really completely shifted the entire energy of the game. And coming to the fourth quarter, that was really the most – that was disaster. Everything crumbled for the Colts. They missed a field goal, and – of course,
it's a 51-yarder, though.
And it was Matt Stover. He hadn't hit a 50-yarder since his first year, in 1993. And then, of course, the Tracy Porter interception. Let me go back to this one. Peyton Manning was throwing his bread and butter play, and the wide receiver was cutting to the left a little bit. And he was going to curl around to the right, and he was going to throw it to the right. Well, the Tracy Porter read the play from the beginning. He knew exactly what Peyton Manning was going to throw. Peyton Manning would tell you that it was an amazing play, but really, and that some people would say he made a mistake, but really, everyone was doing what they were supposed to do. But Tracy Porter knew exactly where he was going to throw it. He stopped them, and he's going to go into Saints lore for the rest of his life.
Yes, indeed. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen talking about the Super Bowl. The Saints win 31-17.
And in Connecticut, an explosion blew apart a power plant under construction in a town called Middleton. At least 5 people are dead. They're still searching for other casualties. Lucy Nalpathanchil now joins us. She's a reporter and producer at WNPR in Connecticut. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning, Celeste.
What is the latest on casualties in Middletown?
Well, here's what we know. As of last night at a briefing, there are 5 confirmed dead, up to 14 injured. When this accident first happened, there were discussions that up to 100 people could have been on site. We now know there were about 50 construction workers on site at this power plant in Middletown, Connecticut, doing some routine work when this explosion happened. So right now it's really a search and rescue situation. There are search dogs on the scene. Emergency responders from around the state have descended upon Middletown, helping to try to find more bodies, possibly survivors of these workers that were on site when that explosion happened yesterday morning.
Well, the plant was under construction. We've heard already that authorities have said it is not terrorism. Do we have any idea what the cause was?
A lot of the officials, fire officials, say that they were doing a procedure known as a blowdown, where they're purging in these pipelines of natural gas when the explosion happened. And again, this explosion was so powerful that it could be felt about 20 miles away. It pretty much ricocheted down what's known as the Connecticut Valley region because this plant is right by the Connecticut River. So it was a very scary moment for residents in town as well as around the state because people didn't know what was happening. And again, we're finding out that it's been contained to this site in Middletown, these construction crew on site. There might be many people buried under metal, the rubble. Right now, they don't have a number of how many people they're looking for.
Okay, Lucy Nalpathanchil, she's a reporter and producer at WNPR.
Todd Zwillick, our Washington takeaway correspondent, joins us now with a portrait of Obama-style bipartisanship after the Democrats are licking their wounds from the results of that Massachusetts election and losing the 60-vote majority there in the Senate. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John.
What's bipartisanship sound like? You have a little example.
Yeah, well, the president went on CBS television right before the Super Bowl. CBS carried the Super Bowl. He knew people would be watching, gave Katie Couric an interview, and invited Republicans to the table. Listen to this one to talk about health care.
How do you guys want to lower costs? How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it?
Of course, he's talking to the American people more than Republicans, so he can actually pick up the phone and talk to right there in Washington.
Right, he is. And what you're seeing, I think, is a continuation of a shift in strategy from the White House. Of course, we all know they lost in Massachusetts. One of the messages the Democrats say they got from that race is more transparency, bring the GOP, more cooperation in Washington. Well, what the president is doing with this is saying, well, you know, Republicans, you've been doing your traditional role of sniping from the wings, criticizing. It's been working very well. Tell you what. February 25th, come on television in this meeting. Let's hear your healthcare ideas. You know, Democrats, one advantage they do have is their healthcare ideas have always polled much more popular with the public right. than Republicans. So, hey, let's hear your ideas. Let's let the public decide. And instead
bully,
of just shooting us from the wings.
Bully
you know?
Pulpit management there from the White House. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up after the Tea Party's convention last week, do they vanish without a trace or do they actually set an agenda of any kind? We're going to look at that with Marcus Mabry of The New York Times and the BBC's Rob Watson and also talk about a major NATO offensive in Afghanistan coming up this week. But right now, let's check on the top news stories at coming up on 31 minutes after the hour. Last night, this was the call that kick-started the party in New Orleans.
Manning pumps right, looks left, throws over the middle, and it's incomplete. Get ready to party with the Lombardi, New Orleans. The miracle in Miami has happened. The Saints have won the Super Bowl.
The Saints have won the Super Bowl. They win the Lombardi Trophy, and the dancing continues in New Orleans, 31-17. It was the Saints' first Super Bowl win. Fire officials in Middletown, Connecticut, say they don't know if everyone's accounted for after a massive explosion at a power plant there yesterday. Rescue workers still can't explore an unstable portion of the unfinished building. The blast occurred as gas lines were being tested. It killed at least five workers.
Washington, D.C. is digging out from the snow following a weekend blizzard. Government offices are shut down due to hazardous travel conditions. Another 5 inches of snow could be on the way, and markets are up slightly. The Dow is trading at 10,012. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
Good morning, everyone. It may be buried by headlines about the Super Bowl and possibly Sarah Palin speaking over the weekend, but really the big thing going forward this week is the major military offensive in Afghanistan that is expected to take place any day now. The goal is to take the Taliban stronghold of Marja in the Helmand province. This will be the biggest offensive since President Obama announced his increase of 30,000 more troops to the war. Here is General Stanley McChrystal in Kabul yesterday.
All the planning for this operation has been led by the civilian side, with the military in support. And, of course, this is an Afghan-led operation. That's the thing that has been so impressive thus far.
Oh, what will we be thinking about the operation by the end of the week? Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, joins us in the studio. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joins us from London. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. You'll have to excuse me if I'm a bit slow because I stayed up to watch some of the Super Bowl, and as you can imagine, with the time difference.
So did we all. And it's one of the few times that we actually are sympathetic about the time difference for
Coffee
you, Rob.
Provided
today. That's right, exactly. So let's talk about what's at stake here in Afghanistan. It's Afghan led. Stanley McChrystal is actually announcing it in advance with the idea of kind of intimidating the Taliban. In terms of on the ground, do they need to take Marjan in the next couple of days for this to be effective?
I'm not sure that they need to take it in the next couple of days, but in many ways this is all about momentum and all about the new way of fighting in Afghanistan, the new way of trying to win this conflict. So it certainly has to be a success. And obviously, to some extent, the ground has been prepared, both here in the US, in the UK, where about 5,000 British troops will be involved, and in the US for the idea that there could be heavy casualties.
And Marcus Mabry, what do you think is at stake? And the president hasn't mentioned much about Afghanistan and this surge, and I'm wondering if that's deliberate.
Well, everything's at stake at this point. You know, the American public support for the war effort is waning greatly. One of the few, so we have to show market progress on the ground. Stan McChrystal has talked about some of that happening already. We have to do more if we're going to keep public support going. One of the merciful kind of
things that the president's been spared with the victory of Scott Brown up in Massachusetts,
right,
taking his old seat, the kind of obsession right now with whether or not the Democrats can survive, can get their health care reform going, keep it on life support, our jobs, comes from the fact that now they're, Afghanistan's off the boiler for the president.
And what they're trying to get on the boiler or on the agenda this week, certainly congressional Democrats want a vote on a jobs bill today. Here's Harry Reid.
96% of the jobs created in the last 10 years have been by small businesses. So we're going to have to focus on letting more entrepreneurs do their thing.
Can the Democrats co-opt this entrepreneurs give money to small business message that's been so popular with Republicans and regain the high ground on jobs this week?
Well, it's kind of amazing. Democrats have to turn to jobs, of course. But it's kind of amazing that the Democrats are actually talking about things like small business right now and small business tax credits. Those are, you know, phrases you have not heard often put together in Democratic mouths. But the fact that the Democrats have co-opted that central ground, that kind of moderate Republican ground, really, I think, shows how serious they are about, number one, getting something that politically is viable in Washington. It's going to be hard for the Republicans to say, sit back with their hands folded on this, something that has both the phrase small business tax credits and the phrase jobs in it and not do anything.
But does it get Republican votes? That's the huge question.
That's exactly the question. It's hard to imagine, again, that some Republicans won't come on board. You know, in the Senate, again, the Republicans can stop every single legislative measure from happening if they want by threatening the filibuster. They could do that. It would be pretty unconscionable that they would do that in this regard. And if they do, then they're really overplaying their political hands, and the Democrats have an opening there to say, look, we're trying to do help small businesses. We're trying to do, give tax credits to small businesses. We're not looking to spend big government money. We're trying to help entrepreneurs.
At the risk of creating an international incident, Rob Watson?
Yes.
Do you know what an onside kick is? Can you explain that to me?
Well,
you watched the Super Bowl last night, correct?
Yes, I did.
And
I've just been rewatching the highlights, I have to confess. An onside kick is when you take a short kick rather than punting it all the way down in the hope of turning over possession.
He did very well.
It's pronounced, John. It's the same thing in rugby. So maybe that's how it is.
Oh, nice, nice. All right. So how big of a deal is the Super Bowl in the UK, Rob Watson, aside from your own personal proclivities?
Well, to get into it, to make it a bit personal to start with, my neighbour in Oxford is from New Orleans, and so it's been very big. He's been telling me about it all, so I was kind of watching out of sympathy with him, so no doubt he's got a bit of a sore head this morning. But the BBC has taken over coverage of it here in the UK, so I guess I've got to wave the rattle for that. I think it is pretty big. You know, I'm sure a lot of people will have stayed up, and for most of the time we took the main US coverage, but we had a little pre-show of our own, and you know, I do think that if British people stay up in time to see that part of America, you just can't help but love it. I mean, the bit where the jets fly over just after the national anthem, as a long-time resident of the U.S., I just go weak at the knees for that stuff.
I love that. That's fantastic. And you know, I guess it also says that New Orleans really is an international city with an international sort of identity. Let's end the agenda with Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party convention in Nashville. Listen.
The Obama Pelosi Reid agenda. It's going to leave us less secure, more in debt, and more under the thumb of big government. And that is out of touch, and it's out of date. And if Scott Brown is any indication, it's running out of time.
All right, so the former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin is back. Did she and the National Tea Party convention in Nashville move the needle at all, and are they likely to move the needle this week?
They haven't moved the needle yet, but what's clear is if we look at the amount of media attention that they got, this really relatively small gathering, it shows a kind of, you know, political mojo that's on their side. Certainly the media attention will continue to be focused on them.
And of course, there was the inevitable question on Fox News. Here's Chris Wallace and Sarah Palin.
Why wouldn't you run for president?
I would. I would if I believe that that is the right thing to do for our country and for the Palin family. Certainly, I would do so.
Which is a harder question to answer. What's right for the country or what's right for the Palin family?
Well, you know, I think what's right for the Republican Party is the hard thing to answer.
Good answer. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and an expat Super Bowl fan, Rob Watson, over there in London. Thanks, Rob.
If we look at the complicated issue of international adoption following last week's arrest of 10 Americans charged with attempting to kidnap 33 children from Haiti, And we're also asking you today a question about last night's Super Bowl. What did you take away from the game? Was it the rise of the Saints, the comeback of the Saints, maybe the what this means for the city of New Orleans? What did you take away from the game? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Election officials in Ukraine say they've now counted 93% of the votes cast in Sunday's presidential election, and opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych is still in the lead, but his margin is now less than 2.5%. His opponent, Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, is refusing to admit defeat and has appealed to her election team around the country to fight for every vote. Oleksiy Soloubenko joined us earlier. He's the head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. With Yanukovych still in the lead, I asked him if the candidate is still projected to win.
I think probably yes. I think there were all sorts of things from Yulia Tymoshenko, all sorts of announcements and calls from Yulia Tymoshenko's headquarters. But it appears that the margin is sufficient enough to call it a valid election. And also various observers from the US, from the European Union, from Russia are saying that basically the polling went well and democratically. And therefore, I think it will be very difficult for her to challenge it, either through courts or through mass rallies.
Meaning that the result was reflected in the exit polls, which also showed Yanukovych walking away with the win. But could Tymoshenko stage a successful contesting of the election results?
I don't think at this stage this is possible, frankly. She would like to, but I think the overwhelming body of evidence coming from the electoral districts from across Ukraine is that actually the results are overwhelmingly in favor of Yanukovych. The margin, as you said, is very, very small, and the hope was on her side that if it is as small as it is, she would be able to reverse it. We're talking about 500,000, maybe 600,000 votes as the margin, but I think it will be very difficult for her to do it because of the overwhelming acceptance of the elections as democratic by various observers at this stage.
Well, Tymoshenko was a large figure in the protests known as the Orange Revolution about 5 years ago that put Ukraine onto a pro-Western slant. Is Yanukovych going to be moving the country in the other direction?
I think in some areas, yes. He already said that he will renegotiate the extension of the Russian Black Sea fleet stationing in Crimea, in Sevastopol. He also said he will look into the status of the Russian language in Ukraine and reverse some of the previous politics. I think he is very cold about NATO, and I don't think that either of the people engaged in this final round of presidential race were very, very keen on joining NATO. However, he wants to be part of the European Union. He understands that European Union is now the greatest trading partner with Ukraine. And therefore, yes, he will be friendly with Russia, more friendly than the previous president was. But I don't think he'll be a puppet. He won't be in cahoots with the Russian business, with Russian politicians. He'll be defending the interests of Ukraine, perhaps less vocally than the previous authorities.
Oleksiy Soloubenko is the head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. He joined us earlier from Bush House to talk about the election results in Ukraine. At this point, 93% of votes have been counted. It looks like the opposition leader, Viktor Yanukovych, is in the lead and will probably walk away with the presidential win.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the complications of international adoption. There are fewer and fewer of those adoptions taking place, but they're more and more complicated than ever. That's after those 10 Americans were charged with attempting to kidnap 33 Haitian children. How typical of the story is that? We'll find out right after the headlines. And here's a check on leading stories. It's coming right up to 48 minutes after the hour. The latest on that explosion in Middletown, Connecticut. A Connecticut fire official says some people may still be trapped in the rubble. Deputy Fire Marshal Al Santostefano says because crews still haven't been able to search an unstable section of the plant.
Other agencies have brought in their search and rescue dogs. They're in the process of doing that right now, trying to get through the rubble up there.
Five people were dead, and the explosion could be heard 30 miles away. The Super Bowl was last night. The Saints beat the Colts 31-17. Damon Marbut, a restaurant manager in New Orleans, says it's a crazy atmosphere.
The entire city is just blown up, and I think my restaurant's destroyed. It's going to take my entire staff a good 2 hours to try to put it back together. It's absolutely wonderful.
The Super Bowl is a big entertainment night, big spectacle. It's also big business. Television advertisements during this year's Super Bowl reached some 100 million Americans. It's also a global phenomenon, though. Foreign businesses use the broadcast to advertise and then strengthen their brand. We were joined earlier by BBC's David Quinn from London. And I asked David, how big of a deal is the Super Bowl outside of the United States?
It's getting bigger and bigger, I could say, and its popularity continues to grow outside the US. And we are talking about very different markets such as Mexico, the UK, Australia, Japan. Many, many countries are now watching the Super Bowl and now following the NFL games. This year, for example, in London in October, we'll have another NFL game, the 49ers against the Denver Broncos in October, and that would be the 11th NFL game that is played in London and the third one of a regular season game. So you can imagine that it's getting bigger and bigger.
Do we have any evidence that the advertising during the Super Bowl actually works in other countries?
Well, you know, for example, I can tell you about the example of Mexico. In Mexico, what happens is that the advertisements that you see in the U.S. is not the same that it's broadcast in Mexico. But what you see there is that local advertisers, probably a global brand with a local touch, will use the Super Bowl to launch their own advertisement, but with the NFL logo. So it's, again, the same show business of advertisement, but with a local flavor and always using the NFL brand. So everybody feels that like they are watching the live ads on the Super Bowl.
Okay, David Quinn from the BBC talking about advertisements during the Super Bowl. Thanks so much. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find adventure. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
This morning's family segment is motivated by the issues raised by the arrest of those 10 American Baptist Church members and the 33 children they tried to take out of the earthquake-devastated nation of Haiti. In the world of international adoptions, the issues vary from nation to nation. Diplomats may be involved as much as social workers. Relations between the country of origin and the adoptive home may be as important as the family-to-family issues. And as parents learn, there is also a wide variance in the degree of candor about the circumstances of the adoptive children from country to country. David Smolin and his wife learned some of these lessons firsthand. David is a professor of law and a self-described inter-country adoption reformer. Good morning from Alabama, David.
Yes, morning.
Well, first of all, what are the unique perils and difficulties associated with country-to-country adoptions that you wouldn't find in a purely domestic adoption?
Well, I'd say it's that most inter-country adoption agencies in the U.S. don't really know that much about what goes on in the other country and don't take responsibility legally, ethically, for how the child is obtained and whether the child is a true orphan. There's a tendency to outsource all of the important work to a foreign orphanage or foreign just someone who comes to them or that they recruit and they pay to find children.
Right. Now, you know, many people in America who know anything at all about international adoptions may get their impression from listening to celebrities talk about their experience. Here's Brad Pitt.
You know, I look at my sons and my daughters, and one's from Vietnam and one's from Cambodia and one's from Ethiopia, and there's this kid who was born in Namibia. Each one of them offers so much to the mix.
And we can only hope that Brad knows the actual names of the children in his own home. But, I mean, this celebrity idea that you can sort of pick and make a kind of, United Nations General Assembly around your breakfast table is really a misnomer and has nothing to do with what parents like yourselves went through.
Well, the problem is that there aren't as many orphans as people think there are. There are a lot of poor families who are willing to place children into some kind of place so they can get an education and that they can get room and board. But a lot of times those families do not intend to actually give up their children. But somewhere in this mix, children who are not true orphans end up getting placed into families here. And that's quite a tragedy.
What happened to you in 1998 when you adopted two girls from India? And congratulations for that, by the way.
Yeah. Well, what happened is that we went through a very well-accredited, very reputable agency here, and yet, despite that, And despite trying to adopt older children for whom there's more of a need, we ended up tragically taking children away from a family who had a family. Their mom had been tricked into placing them somewhere just for room and board and for an education, when in fact the Indian orphanage intended to profit from placing them overseas.
Wow. So David Smolin, this idea of trafficking, which was raised by the Haitian church members, or the American church members who are trying to get kids out of Haiti, is actually something that people might encounter without knowing it.
Exactly. We've had trafficking scandals in China now, Guatemala, Nepal, India, Cambodia, Vietnam, Samoa. So it's become quite a common thing. And also we've had it in the past in Haiti as well.
So David, what did you do when you discovered that there was a family back in India of your two daughters?
Well, we had to do it on our own, because even though we used a very reputable agency, they wouldn't help us figure it out. So we had older children, and they were coached to lie to us, tragically.
Oh.
And when the story emerged through their own friend, who'd been adopted into a different family here, they were pretty sure something was wrong, but they really didn't know, tragically, whether their mother had sold them or been tricked. And that just absolutely tortured them. The agency took the position that they did not need to know and that we did not need to know. So it took about 6 years to find somebody in India willing to go and try to find the rural village where our daughters said they were from. This had to be done gently, because we were told that if she had given them up voluntarily, the mom that is, that she could be harmed if someone went looking for her. So we had to find an appropriate person to do it, and because our agency, which is now a Hague-accredited agency, would not help us, we had to find our own way, which took a long time.
Well, and it's a heroic effort. You and your daughters are in contact now with their birth parents, and all through your own efforts, the institutions didn't help at all. And fortunately, you created a happy ending out of this, which should be a cautionary tale to anyone trying to do country-to-country adoptions. David Smolin, thanks so much for sharing that with us. David Smolin is a law professor and an inter-country adoption reformer who has two daughters adopted from India who, it turned out, were part of a trafficking effort. He attempted to rectify it on his own and made, as we said, heroic efforts there.
So we're asking you about last night's Super Bowl game in New Orleans. What did you take away from the game?
The game was great. Some of the commercials were a little lame, and I wish they would get some more entertainment at halftime. You know, lately all they've been doing is having those old-time rockers on there.
That's Walt from Detroit. What was
Janet
your
Janet Jackson scared them. That's
well, I don't think anyone cares if Pete Townsend opens his shirt. I think that's the thing. Give us your take. It's at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on our website, thetakeaway.org. You can also go to thetakeaway.org or iTunes to subscribe to our podcast in case you want to rehear something or hear it for the first time. And here's your takeaway.
They haven't moved the needle yet, but what's clear is if we look at the amount of media attention that they got, this really relatively small gathering, it shows a kind of, you know, political mojo that's on their side. Certainly the media attention will continue to be focused on them.
That's Marcus Mabry with his analysis of the political mojo behind the Tea Party political movement.
I wonder if that's in the New York Times style book. Marcus Mabry, of course, with the New York Times political mojo as opposed to
and how you can use it and the specific grammatical rules under which one uses mojo.
Marcus knows. He's a wordsmith, I have to say.
As always, we're taking your nominations for who has a good week and who has a bad week, which we will let you know who won on Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is so far, what will we say about this week? Bad week, I would say, so far.
Not if you're in New Orleans.
Not if you're in New Orleans. This is the takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.